This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area, Friday, November 2nd, 2012. For the first time in years, the upcoming state budget will not be centered on making deep cuts. Governor John Hickenlooper unveiled his budget proposal yesterday. It doesn't include any major cuts and instead asks lawmakers for more money for education and economic development projects. State employees would also see a pay raise. Benta Berklin has more from the state capitol.
State workers haven't had a pay raise in 4 years. Governor Hickenlooper's budget would give them a cost of living increase. Part of that money would help cover higher health insurance premiums. The governor's budget would also allow for merit-based raises. Hickenlooper says it's a modest increase.
I think they're going to want a larger raise. Higher ed has seen dramatic cuts. They obviously made clear that they think they should have a greater amount restored to their budgets. Of every place where we've restored funds, I am unaware of any example where they don't feel there's still greater need.
Higher education will get about $37 million. Hickenlooper's budget would also add $2 million to promote tourism in Colorado and create a statewide brand. The governor also wants to put about $200 million additional dollars into K-12 schools and add more money for mental health services in prisons. He says he's prioritizing the last and the least.
The recovery leaves us in cautiously optimistic. This is a budget that we believe is prudent, sustainable.
The governor will formally present his budget to the state legislature's Joint Budget Committee later this month. And adjusting for inflation and population growth, spending is still about $1 billion below the level it was at 5 years ago. Hickenlooper says it'll be years before the budget is fully restored. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
In related news, Governor Hickenlooper announced appointments to the Coal Mine Board of Examiners yesterday. Richard Clare Chermak of Hotchkiss was reappointed to serve as a Colorado coal miner of known experience and practice in underground coal mining who is actively engaged in the coal mining industry during the term of office. Sounds like that came right out of some legalese, didn't it? Justin Kenneth Evans of Crawford was appointed to serve as a Colorado mine owner, operator, manager, or other mine official actively engaged in the underground coal mining industry during the term of office. The board prepares and conducts examinations for all applicants to positions in coal mines that require certification under federal law. The board issues certificates of competency to those who qualify and provides assistance in developing curricula for coal miner training programs. The appointments must be confirmed by the Colorado Senate and will expire July 1, 2016. As a battleground state, all eyes have been on Colorado during this year's presidential race. But the outcome of next Tuesday's election will dictate a lot more than who wins the Oval Office. It will also have a profound impact on local politics, including the possible reversal of a new court-ordered policy allowing guns on college campuses. From KUNC in Greeley, Kirk Siegler has more.
Okay, everyone, thanks very much. I will see you all on Thursday.
Professor Susan Kent hasn't yet had a student bring a concealed weapon into one of her history classes at the University of Colorado in Boulder, but that hasn't stopped her from imagining just about every scenario of what could happen if or when one of them does.
This is a room that contains or can contain 50 to 60 students or so. What if someone sees that concealed weapon and responds to it in alarm? Now, what we've just done in that scenario is completely unsettled the classroom experience.
Guns change the dynamic, says Kent, especially in a learning environment, a classroom like this or a professor's office, that are meant to be safe havens for the exchange of ideas. That's why CU faculty members have the discretion to prohibit all sorts of things in class, she says.
So we can control the presence of laptops and cell phones, but we cannot control the presence of weapons in our class, concealed weapons in our classroom. And we think that is just the most illogical aspect of all of this.
By all of this, Kent is referring to a March ruling by the Colorado Supreme Court that overturned a long-standing Board of Regents policy banning all guns from CU campuses. The court ruled it was trumped by the state's newer concealed carry law passed in 2003. Attorney Jim Manley represented the plaintiffs in the suit.
What I would say to the faculty and students at CU who are uncomfortable with this idea is go talk to your colleagues at CSU. Ask them what it's been like over the last 10 years. Has CSU been a wasteland for academic discourse?
Colorado State University has allowed concealed carry on their campuses since the state law was passed and with no major problems, says Manley. But like CU, CSU leaders did try, albeit unsuccessfully, to ban guns recently. For Boulder State Representative Claire Levy, these types of heated clashes demonstrate why a blanket state law allowing concealed carry permits nearly everywhere doesn't work.
The campuses are responsible for the safety of the students on campus. They're responsible. They create the workplace for faculty and staff. You know, they're an employer, just like, and a custodian of students, if you will, just like K through 12 and just like a private employer is.
Levy plans to draft a bill for the next legislative session that would either hand authority back to college campuses to make their own gun policies or include every university and community college in the state under an existing list of exemptions from the 2003 concealed carry law. Whether she goes with that last, more sweeping route will depend on whether her party, the Democrats, regain control of the state house. But things may also hinge on the makeup of the Board of Regents itself.
I've been pretty unequivocal about my opposition to having concealed carry on any of our college campus, and that continues to be my position. However, the law is what the law is.
Democrat Stephen Ludwig was asked about the gun policy during a recent debate for candidates vying for an at-large seat on the board. Ludwig, who currently holds the seat, is in a tight race with Republican challenger Brian Davidson. At that same debate, Davidson said the issue has been decided by the courts and the Board of Regents shouldn't get another say.
I think giving institutional discretion would be a distraction from higher education issues.
Such as the state funding crisis for higher ed, said Davidson. Still, like it or not, it appears the issue will be back in front of state lawmakers, 10 years after the legislature passed the concealed carry law, and much to the chagrin of gun rights advocates like Jim Manley. He says the statewide law eliminates the confusion for gun owners about where they can and cannot legally carry their weapons.
And in a place like Boulder especially, it's so easy to just walk onto campus and not realize that you're walking on campus. It's interwoven with the city. And so to have a different rule for the campus than you have for the rest of Boulder or the rest of Denver just doesn't make a lot of sense.
The situation on college campuses differs from the situation in downtown Denver or Boulder or Grand Junction.
Back on the CU Boulder campus, Professor Susan Kent isn't buying Manley's argument.
We have a lot of partying going on in this campus. We have a lot of immature 21-year-olds who may certainly be in a position to get a permit, but as far as I would argue, aren't mature enough to be in a position to carry a weapon.
Kent, who chairs the university's history department, is a gun owner herself, but she's still urging her fellow faculty members to sign on to legislation reinstating a campus ban. It's not yet clear how much traction this effort will gain, even on this campus, known for its liberal politics. That's mainly because it's not clear how big of an issue concealed weapons even are here. The school estimates literally just a handful of the entire student body of 30,000-plus even has permits. I'm Kirk Ziegler.
A juvenile has been charged with starting the 10,000-acre Weber fire in southwestern Colorado. The blaze caused an estimated $10 million in damage on federal, state, and private lands. The Denver Post reports that the charges, two counts of juvenile delinquency, were filed on Monday. According to a U.S. Attorney's Office release, the juvenile gathered up leaves and underbrush around a bush and, using a Bic lighter, lit the underbrush, causing it to burn and ignite nearby timber. The Post reports that the defendant, who was not identified, will receive a summons to appear in federal court in Durango. The Weber fire started June 22nd near Mancos and forced the evacuation of about 150 people. No homes were burned. If convicted, the juvenile faces a possible prison term and restitution. KVNF has teamed up with the Watch newspapers to bring you stories from Montrose, Ouray, and San Miguel counties. Managing editor Gus Jarvis has this week's report.
Anticipation is building for a potentially heated public hearing process in Nuclea next week, which will help determine the fate of the proposed Pinyon Ridge uranium mill. Richard Dana will preside over the multi-day affair. He's a retired federal judge and co-founder of the Judicial Arbiter Group. Dana is currently accepting written public comments and will continue to accept them until Monday, November 12th at 5 p.m. Dana will also hear oral comments from the public starting at 4 p.m. each day next Wednesday through Friday. All of Monday, November the 12th, has also been set aside as a public comment period starting at 8:30 a.m. Apart from the public comment segments, the rest of the hearing will consist of formal evidentiary process as lawyers from both sides examine and cross-examine a list of 25 witnesses. Proceedings will likely finish on Tuesday, November 13th. The hearing will be held at the Moose Lodge in Nucla. The best way to submit written public comments is via email to rdana@jaginc.com. Dana intends to publish the comments online. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment is holding the hearing to help decide whether to re-grant Energy Fuels a radioactive materials license for the Pinyon Ridge facility. A previous permit was invalidated by a judge earlier this year. In related news, several Telluride residents are upset with the town council for entering into a settlement agreement with Energy Fuels over the proposed Pinyon Ridge Mill. Skip Edwards of the Advocacy Coalition of Telluride led the charge at Tuesday night's meeting. He voiced concern that the town would now be financially responsible for environmental baseline monitoring programs and that having uranium mill in the neighborhood would mar Telluride's reputation for pristine natural beauty. Dana Ivers of the Advocacy Coalition sharply criticized the council for making the decision without public input. And Michael Saffler criticized the council for greenlighting what he called the most polluting industry. Town Attorney Kevin Geiger said that the town had met its legal requirements by posting the revised agenda referencing the settlement agreement 24 hours in advance of the meeting. He dismissed the notion that the settlement agreement was meaningless and didn't afford Telluride any protections, pointing out four substantive areas where the agreement has legal parameters. He said the town is in a stronger position because of the settlement agreement, particularly on the issue of water quality. Several council members expressed that their role on council is separate from their personal opinions and noted that not all of them agreed with the settlement. The vote approving the decision was unanimous, and at the previous meeting, all discussion took place in executive session. A volunteer group of concerned citizens has finished its detailed survey of the Montrose School District and says student achievement has fallen due to a combination of factors. The Montrose Community School Improvement Team presented their findings to the school board last week. The group's report cites drops in tax revenue, millions of dollars in budget cuts, and dozens of layoffs over the past few years, along with increased costs, as leading factors to decreased student achievement. Board President Sheerston Davis hailed the report as a roadmap for progressively better school system in a time of falling achievement and funds. Davis said the goal of the report is to identify every need, identify where needs are falling short, and then specifically target those concerns. The report identifies a lack of sufficient materials, from office supplies to textbooks, and says in certain cases, teachers are forced to make purchases with their own money. The report also details class size, school morale, and teacher retention. Melanie Hall of the volunteer group said the report is only the beginning of a new process to create a better district-wide system. The group will deliver specific school findings to district principals in a couple of weeks. The improvement team has made recommendations to the district regarding a possible sales tax increase or mill levy increase in 2013 to increase revenues. Ridgeway's Streetscape Committee wants community input on how to get the local economy moving. The town adopted a historic business district streetscape plan in 2006, but hasn't done much with it since. To change that, the committee, with the Ridgeway Town Council approval, has prepared a press release, a map, and community survey. They've delivered postcards to every business and property owner in Ridgeway with the request that respondents take an 8-question online survey at the town's webpage. Once the survey responses are in, the committee will review them along with other outreach results and present them to town council. If those findings are positive, the town could move forward with a ballot measure in April to fund the downtown improvements. That's the catch. To revitalize the historic business core, as sketched out in the streetscape plan, it will take about $3.5 million. Money the town doesn't have right now. The proposed infrastructure improvements include paving a few central blocks of major streets, tree planting, new lights and signs, and wide curbs and sidewalks with benches and bike racks. The idea is to encourage a pedestrian, bicycle-friendly downtown to draw motorists off the main drag. The committee wants your input. For more information, visit the town's website or pick up maps and a survey at the Ridgeway Town Hall. You've been listening to the Watch Weekly Report. For KVNF News and the Watch Newspaper, I'm Gus Jarvis.
Four prep football teams in the KVNF listening area have qualified for the state playoffs, and the Hotchkiss girls cross-country team claimed the state title at the 2A cross-country meet in Colorado Springs. KVNF's Tammy Mack reports on these stories and more in this week's Sports Report.
The fact that freshman Sophia Shelley was on a state champion cross-country team didn't quite sink in until she was riding in a parade through Hotchkiss to honor the team on Tuesday.
No, when I finally like looked around, I was like, wow, we're the only people in this parade. But it was fun because, you know, it's like the sport that's usually not recognized was getting that much attention, you know, so it was special.
Shelley, along with freshman May Anderson, sophomore Tiffany Clock, and juniors Jenny Solis and Natalie Anderson, garnered 16 points to claim the 2A title at the Norris Penrose Events Center. Anderson placed third with a time of 20 minutes, 18.6 seconds. Solis placed fourth with a time of 21 minutes. Shelley and May Anderson placed 10th and 11th, and Clock finished 25th out of 77 runners. This is the first state cross-country title for Hotchkiss. It was also unexpected because it's unusual for a team with no seniors to win a state cross-country title. Natalie Anderson, who placed in the top four the last two seasons, gave a lot of credit to head coach Kelly Cowan.
He told us after we won state that he knew that we could do it after our first Delta meet. He knew we had the capability to do it. And then every practice he was encouraging us to be mentally tough and push ourselves and just believe in ourselves so that we can go that much farther and not have the mental barrier.
Anderson says they'd love to get another title next year, but she knows that other teams, like second place Lions, will be out for the win next season.
We always got to keep an eye on Paonia because, anyone can come out of the darkness. Yeah.
Telluride senior Rachel Hampton won the 2A girls division with a time of 19 minutes, 48 seconds. The Hotchkiss boys team of Andrew Tiedemann, Kurt Katzdorn, Tyrell Clock, Bryce Holm, and Cody Bartlett had 53 points to place fourth. Telluride's Jack Plants and Dylan Newell led their team to a second-place finish with 27 points. The Paonia girls team had 57 points to place fourth. Despite stopping to help a runner who had collapsed on the course, junior Taylor Polson finished ninth overall with a time of 21 minutes, 51.9 seconds. Freshman Chelsea Milner was 16th, and senior Chelsea Reed placed 41st to score for the Lady Eagles. Paonia's sole male qualifier, junior Jason Sturgis, placed 28th in a field of 94 runners. In Class 4A competition, Delta senior Cleo Whiting placed 10th with a time of 19 minutes 48 seconds, and twin sister Clarissa came in 8 seconds later to place 11th. Junior Dustin Ombe placed 55th for the Delta boys, and senior Jonathan Kindernecht placed 61st out of 224 runners. State 1A football playoffs begin this week. The Cedar Ridge Bruins ended 1A Western Slope Conference play undefeated after a crushing 46-6 win last Friday over Paonia that ended the Eagles' chance for a wild card berth. Cedar Ridge is seeded third and will host a first-round playoff game against 4-1 Centauri this Saturday at 1. Hotchkiss also advances to the state playoffs. They are seeded 10th and will face number 7 Wiggins this Saturday at Wiggins. Last season, Wiggins ended the Bulldogs' run for a state title with a win in the semifinals. Head coach Zach Lemon says that they are better prepared this season due to their tough schedule and the fact that they have 15 seniors. While they only have 17 on their roster, Wiggins is a big team. Their line ranges from 230 to 280 pounds. Lemon says he'll rely heavily on senior tailback Jacob Galley, a four-year starter and tailback for the Bulldogs, who leads the state in rushing with more than 1,700 yards.
We also know that we're going to have to complete some passes. Those same 250, 280-pound linemen are their defensive line, too, so it's going to be hard to get some creases in the running game, but it's good. It's a fun opportunity to get a chance to get back at them.
This team has what it takes to win, says Galley, who is also a middle linebacker. They've gone deep into the playoffs the last three seasons, and they aren't taking any team for granted.
If everybody does their job, yeah, everything should play out good, but we all have to do our job. If we don't do our job, things don't work.
Both Norwood and Dove Creek advanced to the Class A 8-man state playoffs. Eighth-seeded Dove Creek will host number 9 West Grand in first-round playoffs this Saturday at 1. Fifth-seeded Norwood will host number 12 Fowler, also at 1. For KVNF News, I'm Tammy Mick with your weekly sports report.
This year's U.S. Capitol Christmas tree will once again be from Colorado. Today, the People's Tree, a 73-foot Engelmann spruce, will be cut from the White River National Forest Blanco Ranger District near Meeker and begin making its way to the nation's capital via stops in Colorado and around the country. The tree will be delivered to the U.S. Capitol on November 26th and decorated with 5,000 homemade ornaments from Coloradans before its lighting in December. Colorado's U.S. Senator Mark Udall will lead the official lighting of the tree at the U.S. Capitol on December 4th. The Montrose County Motor Vehicle Office will be closed next Tuesday, November 6th. Staff from that office will be helping with the election that day. The Motor Vehicle Office will reopen on Wednesday, November 7th at 8:30 a.m. Don't forget, daylight savings time ends this weekend. Clocks fall back Saturday night. This concludes the morning newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria.